WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Rick Moody has been described as the preeminent young literary chronicler of suburbia's decay. His novel, The Ice Storm, is set in 1973 as the new sexual freedoms and self-help psychologies come to the suburbs. A new film based on the novel, starring Kevin Kline and Sigourney Weaver, just won the Screen Adaptation Award at the Cannes Film Festival. Moody's new novel, Purple America, is a portrait of a family falling apart. It takes place over the course of one weekend when a son in his 30s comes to his mother's suburban home to help take care of her. Her husband has just walked out on her, and she has a degenerative illness which has left her helpless. Here's Rick Moody reading from the opening of Purple America.
Whosoever knows the folds and complexities of his own mother's body, he shall never die. Whosoever knows the latitudes of his mother's body, whosoever has taken her into his arms and immersed her baptismally in the first floor tub, lifting one of her alabaster legs and then the other over its lip, whosoever bathes her with Woolworth soaps in sample sizes, whosoever twists the creaky taps and tests the water on the inside of his wrist, whosoever shovels a couple of tablespoons of rose bath salts under the billowing faucet and marvels at their vermilion color, whosoever bends by hand her sclerotic limbs as if reassuring himself about the condition of a hinge, whosoever has kissed his mother on the part that separates the lobes of her white hair and has cooed her name while soaping underneath the breast where he was once fed, whosoever breathes the acrid and dispiriting stench of his mother's body while scrubbing the greater part of the smell away with Woolworth's lavender soaps, who has pushed her discarded bra and oversized panties scattered on the tile floor behind him to one side, away from the water sloshing occasionally over the edge of the tub and choking the runoff drain, who has lost his footing on these panties, panties once dotted with the blood of children unconceived, his siblings unconceived, panties now intended to fit over a vinyl undergarment, who has wiped stalactites of drool from his mother's mouth with a moistened violet washcloth, who has swept back the annoying violet shower curtain, the better to lift up his stick figure mother and to bathe her posterior where a sweet and infantile effluent sometimes collects, causing her both discomfort and shame.
Rick Moody, thanks for reading that. This whosoever passage actually goes on for about four pages. That's a really long breath.
Yeah. Hard to read.
How did this opening come to you? The sense of like one long sentence, one long meditation.
Well, I wanted it to be litanical, sort of scriptural in a way. And I'd been reading at the time that I started it one of the Gnostic Gospels, the Gospel of Thomas, which begins with the sentence, "Whosoever reads and understands these sayings, he shall never die." And I just loved the sentence, and I just decided to work with it in a sort of jazz way, you know, improvise on these rhythms.
Well, that's kind of how your whosoever ends, too.
Yeah.
Do you want to read the ending of this for us?
Whosoever in this instant of sorrow and reverence knows the answers to why roses bloom, why wine glasses sing, why human lips, when kissed, are so soft, and why parents suffer, he shall never die.
So how did it feel to basically cop something from the Bible?
Well, it's sort of rash, I admit that, but... The Gnostic Gospels are considered a little bit rash themselves, and the idea in Gnosticism was that one was allowed to freely invent along the lines of faith. So I figured a little more free invention wouldn't hurt anybody's feelings too much.
What were the technical problems of keeping this going for four pages?
Well, for me, the paramount technical problem is trying to stay close to incident and detail and not spin off into abstractions and stuff. So in a way, I'm trying to tell a little bit of story in this chapter, and that becomes really hard. How do you move these people around when the only way you have to move them is introductory adverbial clauses? You know, you don't really get to the meat of the sentence. You're dealing with these fragments over and over again.
Well, I think one of the most disturbing fragments is talking about the character talking about his mother's panties, which, you know, were once more sexual and are now designed to fit over vinyl undergarments. Was it disturbing to you to think about bathing a mother's private parts and seeing her undergarments?
Yeah, it's a deeply painful passage, without a doubt. I mean, the book starts somewhat confrontationally, and you know, I understand. I've heard from readers and understand that it's really hard for people sometimes, and it was hard for me writing it. But my feeling was, you know, I'm in a generation where this kind of situation, if it's not already part of your life, is imminently part of your life because our parents are living longer you know, so these kinds of situations come up. It's part of life now.
Is that part of your life now?
Well, no. Actually, my mother is in really good shape, but her mother died quite young, and my paternal grandmother had Alzheimer's for many years, about 10 years. So I've seen my share of these difficulties.
The mother asked the son to help her commit suicide. Did you, when you were writing this book, wonder how you would respond if that question was posed to you?
Well, actually, Terry, that was the beginning of the book. Because of what happened to my grandmother, you know, she was chronically ill. I mean, my maternal grandmother, I think my mother has been very sensitive to these issues and at a certain point made clear to me that she had plans with respect to any kind of chronic illness if it arose in her situation. As I say, she's quite well now, but she was thinking about these things. And she said to me, you know, I've made these decisions. I have what I need. If I should develop some kind of chronic illness, you know, I want you to know that. And that conversation was so difficult for me that it became the kernel for this entire novel.
Did you wonder, well, how am I supposed to respond to this? Am I supposed to say, hey, great, Ma, you've got it taken care of. You're going to kill yourself if the time comes. Or you're supposed to try to talk her out of it and say, no, I'd be there for you. There'd be no reason for you to take your life. What are you supposed to say?
Well, that's exactly the problem. I mean, what Purple America does for me is not come down on the side of one solution or the other, but present the complexities of trying to answer that question. I would say that in my case, eventually what I said to my mom was, look, you're in great shape. Can you keep this to yourself for now? You know, and we'll talk about it later if something comes up. But I understand, you know, I think that the way people work psychologically is that they inhabit all these positions, both sides of the question, at one time or another. And that's what Dexter Ratliff, the protagonist of Purple America, does. He flip-flops. He inhabits all the possible responses.
My guest is Rick Moody, and his new novel is called Purple America. What is purple about in the title of your novel Purple America?
Well, it has different meanings in different places, and you know, to land on one to the exclusion of the others is a little dangerous, and there's sort of one very specific meaning in the last chapter that I don't want to unravel on the radio. But I will say that there are sort of two preliminary things having to do with purple that suggested to me the title. And the first is the tendency in the 50s, according to my perception, to sort of decorate with pastel. So there was kind of this purple in the decorating palette that is very important in the beginning of the book. And Billy Ratliff, you know, Dexter's mother, being a woman from the 50s, really harkens back to that hue in her decorating scheme. So that's one important part of purple in the title. And the other important aspect of it is that when I set out to write the book, I knew that I wanted to write a book that was operatic with respect to emotion, that was big and sentimental, because you know, it was just an ambition I had to be that full of pathos. So I wanted purple in the sort of sloppy American emotional sense, you know, full of feelings.
You say you wanted to write a big and sentimental novel. I think a lot of fiction today is really filled with irony and detachment. Did that have anything to do with your desire to try sentimentality?
absolutely.
Or sentiment, I should say.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I would make that distinction also. Absolutely, it did have to do with wanting to avoid irony. You know, I as a young writer, I was schooled in sort of the kind of experimental fiction of the 60s and 70s. So I'm well-traveled with respect to experimentation and formal innovation and stuff. I can do all that, but I really wanted to get back to what made fiction exciting for me when I was a kid, which was, you know, character and psychology and emotion and that stuff, and the desire to turn pages to see how people are going to react to calamity and how they're going to get through the mess that they're in.
What did you have to change in yourself as a writer to get from irony to sentiment?
You just have to be willing to go down further. And, you know, as you were saying about the first chapter, it often means that you have to write about things that are difficult and so forth. And that process can be really draining. It's easy to see why people often would be happy to look for another tactic, would be happy to look in another direction. Because writing about this sort of stuff, you know, it's demanding.
Sometimes I think that we've taken refuge in irony because real emotion has been cheapened by these kind of false, over-dramatized, over-sentimentalized displays of emotion in bad literature, in bad movies, in bad TV talk shows and stuff like that. And so to detach ourselves from that kind of bad, sappy display of emotion, we turn to irony.
Yeah, I agree, and it's easy to burlesque. I mean, you can see how people get in the position of sort of burlesquing the big center of American culture because so much of it's so silly sometimes. But I think there really is a place for sort of telling the truth about how emotion really gets articulated and how people really react. I find that stuff so invigorating that, you know, it makes literature exciting for me all over again.
Rick Moody is my guest. His new novel is called Purple America. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Rick Moody. His new novel is called Purple America. An earlier novel of yours called The Ice Storm has just been made into a movie, and it just showed at the Cannes Film Festival, and apparently it's been really well received there. It's directed by Ang Lee, who did Sense and Sensibility, and it stars Kevin Kline and Sigourney Weaver. Tell us a little bit of what the novel is about.
Well, The Ice Storm is set in over the weekend after Thanksgiving in 1973, roughly speaking, when in the northeast of the U.S. there was this tremendous ice storm with snapping power lines and broken plumbing lines and floods and all kinds of damage. And it was, of course, during Watergate. And I was living in Connecticut then with my mom, and our house was devastated by the storm. And the novel mainly concerns these two families, the Hoods and the Williamses. They're called the Carvers in the film for legal reasons, are sort of involved with their daily life, and then suddenly the storm comes and sort of leads them to try to deal more cogently with some of the issues at hand.
Such as?
Well, you got a little sort of suburban adultery, some adolescent sexual exploration, too much drinking, too much taking of drugs, that kind of stuff. It's really, in my way of thinking, the book is about sort of moral duplicity. You know, beginning with the Nixon administration and trickling down to a kind of sort of suburban, maybe moral ambiguity is a better word, or moral confusion, trickling down to these families and their own small moral confusions.
And it's in part, too, isn't it, about a kind of suburban variation on the counterculture and, you know, free love and all that.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you grow up amid that? Did you grow up watching parents or parents of friends indulge in sexual experimentation?
Yeah, there was a little bit of it around. I mean, like I was saying before, the town of New Canaan, where the novel is set and where I actually lived at that time, would prefer that I say that was not the case. But sad to say, I did observe some of it in the neighborhood.
I wonder what that was like. I mean, it's one thing to try things out yourself, and it's another to watch your parents do it. I think a lot of young people would prefer to think of their parents as not sexual, or perhaps as sexual with their other, you know, sexual together, but not with other people. That's a really discomforting experience.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it opens your eyes in ways perhaps that you aren't prepared to have them opened. But that's the times. I mean, I think that did happen to many of my contemporaries.
You worked in publishing houses before you were published yourself, and I think one of your duties was to read manuscripts and write rejection letters. When you started getting rejection letters yourself, what did you start thinking about rejection letters and how they're written?
Well, you know, when I wrote them, when I was in publishing, I always tried to imagine that there was a person at the other end of the letter, you know, since I am a writer myself, that I knew there's a writer out there who's getting this letter. And so I always tried to make them sympathetic in that way. But it's true that you can never really be completely sympathetic about that situation until you've gotten some yourself. And Garden State got many, many, many rejection letters, 22, I think, rejection letters. So I learned quite fast humility in this area.
How personally did you take the rejection letters?
Well, it depended. There were a couple that got under my skin and stayed there for a long time. And in fact, the ice storm was really a reaction against some early criticisms of Garden State. So personally, probably, I didn't take them personally, but I took them seriously in some cases.
What were you reacting to in those rejection letters?
Well, the idea that Garden State was a little bit sort of imaginary and not as sort of realistic as it might have been, and that since I came from the middle class, it was probably at that time impossible for me to really know what it was like to be from the working class. And some characters in Garden State came from the working class. So I realized that it was my duty as a writer really to tell fully the story of the middle class suburbs as I had experienced them before I could move on to learn about other people and other situations.
Well, it sounds in that respect like the letters of rejection actually were very productive.
They were productive. You know, you don't always like them, but they're certainly productive sometimes.
Is there a letter of rejection that you wrote that you're particularly proud of that you thought was very sensitively handled?
No, it's more often my personal burden, Terry, to imagine the ones that I did badly. And there were plenty of those, which I might have done better.
Did you write letters of rejection to people who are now wonderful established writers you admire and who have been praised by critics and so on? In other words, do you feel you really missed the boat with anybody?
You mean like the Decca record executive who turned the Beatles down?
Yeah, exactly. yeah.
Well, there's one I wrote that I feel really annoyed with by a really great writer who's now become the head of the writing program at my alma mater, in fact. And yeah, I felt really badly about that one later. I actually have apologized to her since for it.
How did she take it?
She was mad. In fact, she stayed mad for a good long time.
Do you think that a lot of people of your age read fiction now?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. You know, I try to avoid these kind of demographic analyses in some ways because, you know, I have to think that when I do my job, I'm not trying to reach a demographic group. I'm trying to reach individual readers. You know, it's a relationship between me and a bunch of individuals, you know. That's how literature does its job. It's done solitarily. You know, a writer is now in the hands of a reader. But having said that, you know, I used to think, based on some examples, Thomas Pynchon's Vineland being on the bestseller list, and now Mason and Dixon, his new novel, is about to be on the bestseller list, you know, that there are certain writers who everybody reads. And they're, you know, Pynchon's quite a difficult writer, and yet, you know, he's going to sell 200,000 copies of Mason and Dixon, or maybe more. And that, to me, is very exciting. I used to use those kinds of examples to say literature is fine and it's really a marketing problem, not a sort of cultural problem in some way. But, you know, I do have this sort of sneaking suspicion some days that, you know, that what Jonathan Franzen, for example, has said recently in Harper's is true, that it just doesn't have the same cultural relevance, fiction, that it used to have. You know, that it's not something where you go, oh, I'm going to go read David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest because, you know, this is literature and it's about my nation and it's very important that I should know about this. I think oftentimes, you know, younger people think that the internet is where the action is, or you know, television or something. And so there are more forums competing for this attention now.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
Rick Moody's new novel is called Purple America. His novel, The Ice Storm, has been adapted into a new film starring Kevin Kline and Sigourney Weaver.